About to leave Afghanistan after 4 or 5 years investigating war crimes for Human Rights Watch, Michael Sheikh's Afghan colleagues invited him to dinner. The food was beautiful, a thick golden stew of chickpeas and sour yogurt called Saland Ednakod. As he ate, Michael began to think of the importance of food for people's enduring persecution. He came to see that when a community's food culture is attacked, it can have cascading and devastating implications, not only for the emotional and spiritual well-being of the people, but also their physical existence. In his book, The Last Sweet Bite, Michael Sheikh argues that we need to put food among other examples of intangible cultural heritage that need to be protected at times of war and violence. Not just the recipe, not just the dish of food, but the way people have of organising, cooking, serving, and eating a meal. It matters. Michael will be out here next week for Sydney Writers' Festival. He joins us now from New York. Michael, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honour to be part of the show.
Michael, you grew up not eating the food of your father's people. Is that a driver for this investigation of yours? And I'm wondering what eating American food when a much perhaps richer cuisine was available has done to you.
Well, in many ways, it stems from an issue around language, my interest in food traditions. When I was a little kid, I thought my dad had these magic powers. He could speak three languages, Urdu, Sindhi, and English. He was born in Pakistan and came to the US to become a doctor. But I'd see at Christmas parties, or I'd see when he was talking to my aunts and uncles, him speaking these languages, and it was like this magic world that he entered, and I really wanted to get into it. And I asked my dad one day if he could teach me Sindhi, his native language. And he said, no, you don't need it. You're an American kid growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. What's the use? And your mother doesn't speak it, so don't worry about it. You know, I went to Pakistan as a little kid often, and I'd, you know, get poked fun of by my cousins in another language I couldn't understand. And it kind of like really put a chip on my shoulder. And I was begging my dad, like, come on, teach me this language so I can fight back in my own, in the same language. It's like, no, you don't need it. You know, the brushback was painful, but logical. I understood where he was kind of coming from. He was a doctor, he was busy. My mom didn't speak it. But the language bug never really left me. I was really fascinated by language. I studied Japanese pretty intensively in college, and I went to go live there after college. And I was in this small little fishing village in Japan, and I would go to this izakaya every night, a Japanese pub, and it was run by this incredible woman named Keiko. And over the course of my couple years living there, she took me under her wing, and I kind of became her. She became my like Japanese mother. And I spent a lot of time on both sides of her bar, drinking and washing dishes on busy nights, drinking on slow nights, washing dishes, and sometimes helping to cook. You know, being single at that time, she was kind of worried that I wasn't eating very well. So on slow nights, she taught me how to cook. And one night, she pulled me behind the bar, and during one of these impromptu cooking classes, she was teaching me how to cook this really incredible fried chicken, karaage, that her family put their own spin on. The recipe's in the book. And I had this kind of, standing over her shoulder, I had this kind of wave of guilt wash over me. Here I am, learning her family recipes in her language, and I couldn't do that on my own. I left Japan and went back to Ohio on my way to graduate school in California. And before I left, I was reconnecting with my dad. And we started talking about Pakistan, and as we sometimes do, and you know, talking about family, friends, gossip. But during that conversation, it was the first time he really opened up to me about partition, the violent breakup of India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
And it was really bloody. It was genocidal. My father was a teenager at that point, and he saw a lot of it. And we kind of broached the language issue again. And I'm like, Dad, so tell me again, why didn't you teach us Sindhi? And over the course of that conversation, it became very clear to me how ever-present partition was in his life, what he had seen, what he witnessed, what he felt. That kind of violence had kind of fused onto his culture and the things that he loved. And he told me simply that it was just too painful for him to speak his language sometime, that it was too hard for him to teach it to my brother and sister and I. And in that moment, I saw this kind of tentacle reach down through history and steal part of my culture from me. And I could see that happening to other South Asians around the world. And it was a profound kind of awakening in me. Kind of fast forward, I'm in Afghanistan, and a dear friend of mine, Tamim, invites me over for dinner. And it was like one of my last meals in the country before I was leaving. And I'd been there for 3 or 4 years already, working for Human Rights Watch, International Crisis Group, which Gareth Evans, your former foreign minister, used to be my boss. Tamim had this dinner in front of us, and then one of these dishes was this salan de nahud, this beautiful Afghan chickpea curry, but I hadn't seen it before. And I kind of arrogantly asked Tamim if that dish was Afghan. I had been in the country for several years and hadn't seen it before, and arrogantly, how could I know a cuisine in 4 years? And kind of in that, you know, that stupid, arrogant question, Tamim kind of cautioned patience, like, listen, Michael, it is Afghan, but the reason why you haven't seen it is because of the reasons why Afghanistan is at war in the first place. And Tamim was an Afghan man and is an Afghan man, and he had been a refugee like many Afghans many times in his life. And like millions of Afghans had taken his culinary knowledge with him outside of the country when they fled. Think about when you're leaving home and you take the most important things with them. Many Afghans, like many refugees around the world, didn't have an opportunity to take very many of their physical belongings, but they took a lot of their cultural memory with them. But on top of that, the war had made ingredients scarce. It had unexploded ordnance, landmines and bombs and fields had made farming harder to do. And many of the older generation that carried these recipes in their minds and hearts were killed. And so it just, this accumulation of different factors around the war, Tamim said, had started narrowing the language of Afghanistan's food culture. And in that moment, I saw that same tentacle that had reached down through history to steal my part of my culture was doing a very similar thing to Afghanistan's culinary heritage. And it really struck me. And everywhere I went after that, I started asking, how is the violence as a human rights investigator that I'm investigating not only changing the people's lives, but how is it changing the society around them? The art, the architecture, the music, and the food. And by asking that question, it really opened my eyes to just the profound ways that violence affects all of us, but also the really profound ways that human beings go to protect the things they love. And one of those things is our culinary traditions. And so I saw just how important these recipes were. People would talk about recipes in war zones,
yes,
that were disappearing, like losing a family member. And so it just became this kind of goal of mine to put kind of culinary traditions on par with other forms of heritage and try to get them protected in times of war.
You write beautifully about people being, you know, spending perhaps years barely getting by, barely finding the food to nourish them. And then being able to eat their food and what it does.
Yeah. You know, I one of my last kind of formal human rights jobs was investigating some of the genocidal violence in Myanmar against the Rohingya population. And for the Rohingya are a small Islamic minority in Western Myanmar on the border of Bangladesh. And in 2017, a pretty terrible genocide unfolded. Thousands were killed, actually countless people were killed, we don't really know. And about 1 million were pushed into Bangladesh. But in the course of fleeing that violence, I met some families who had to survive in the jungle between Myanmar and Bangladesh. And they lived on grasses, leaves, and twigs. And this is a community, these are a people that have one of the most beautiful cuisines in kind of South and Southeast Asia. It's this hybrid between Southeast Asia and South Asian cuisine. And it's very unique in the world. It mixes some of the most incredible ingredients that you would associate with Indian food and say Thai cuisine. And it was kind of heartbreaking to hear how they had been forced to live on grass and leaves. But when they got to Bangladesh, when they got to the safety of the camps, they had their first dish of rice and dal, lentils. And they said, in that moment, I became human again. I became Rohingya again. And I saw, like, it just reiterated to me, like, how important our food cultures are. Like, not only do they remind us of our humanity, they remind us of our identity as part of a group and as part of a family. And, you know, that really is kind of one of the things I think is underestimated in kind of the conflict humanitarian world, is that we spend so much money protecting other forms of culture, like art and architecture, but we spend very little protecting these forms of culture that are really integral to our societies, that keep us together as people, that keep us together as communities. And so by putting these two things on par with each other, I think would really kind of help keep communities whole and healthy, even in times of, or more healthy in times of crisis.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Michael Shaikh, who is the author of the book, The Last Sweet Bite, looking at the importance of the culture of food in times of violence and refugee in a refugee world. Michael, this goes back, I think, to your own experience. Is the role of women in this? Now, if your mother had also been Pakistani, you would have eaten that food, wouldn't you, as you grew up?
Yeah, and I probably would have spoken Sindhi, or if she was Sindhi.
Yes.
It was a lot easier. But here, yeah, I mean, the role of women in culinary culture, in creating culinary culture, is paramount. I mean, you brought up my mom. You know, my mom grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. She had a good childhood, but kind of an isolating one. It was just her, my grandparents, and my uncle. There weren't any cousins that kind of came around at Christmas time or birthdays to open presents or eat cake. There was an old family kind of conflict that kind of kept everyone isolated from each other. But my mom insisted, when she became a mother, that her children would have kind of the childhood in terms of the big family culture that she wanted, that she wished she had. And over the past 50 years, through births, deaths, adoptions, like our Christmas dinner table, our Thanksgiving dinner table, our birthday dinner tables get bigger and bigger. And she's created this incredible family culture. There's even new dishes that are incorporated that have become tradition. And I could see over the course of these decades, my mom creating this really powerful culture that's gonna last, because I see my sister and my cousins kind of wanted to take up that kind of cultural role. And to me, that really emphasizes in my personal life the profound role that women and girls play in building humanity's culinary cultures. Since time immemorial, women have been doing this for us. And I think if we are serious about, if we care about food, and if we're interested in the people making the food, we have to be interested in what's happening to them and have better strategies for protecting them. And that is really women and girls, because they are disproportionately impacted by violence. And I think one of the ways that we can do this is by outlawing the crime of domicide. Domicide is the intentional flattening of homes, villages, entire towns, much like you see in Gaza or Mungda in Myanmar, in Mariupol or in Ukraine or Aleppo in Syria or Homs. That is not a crime that is out prescribed in our international law. But when you destroy a home, when you destroy a kitchen, when you destroy a market, that's primarily where many women and girls spend their time. And so when you destroy that, you're destroying much of our culture. And I think if we begin to outlaw that, it's one step in kind of helping preserve one of humanity's greatest forms of culture. And so again, if you're serious about protecting food, you got to be serious about protecting the people who make our food cultures, and that's women and girls.
And in times of peace, you have to be serious about getting the recipes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. One of the most kind of fascinating and heartwarming kind of elements about this book process, I hadn't really thought about it very much, but a school in Ohio is actually teaching my book, and a high school. And I went to go speak to the students, and one of the students said to me, because of what I read in your book, it made me have a better relationship with my grandmother. I started asking more about where she came from, what her food culture was, and I'm starting to learn more about my food. And I gotta say that when she told me that, that made the 3 years of writing absolutely worth it. But yeah, I mean, it's an intergenerational thing. Food is a language. It tethers us to our community and to our parents and to our grandparents.
You mentioned a moment ago the flattening of Gaza and domicide. Another way of humiliating Palestinians in Gaza is to prevent fishing.
Yes. You know, the story of starvation in Gaza has predated the weaponization of food in Gaza by the Israeli government has predated October 7th. I mean, for a very long time, they've been restricting fishermen from going out to sea. They've been confiscating land in the West Bank, olive farms. They're preventing, from what I've heard from different Palestinian activists, is preventing seeds, fruit that carries seeds, and vegetables that carry seeds into the occupied territories, because seeds carry memory. They carry, you know, the ability to grow your own food and knowledge. And so by preventing food with seeds from getting in, you are kind of blocking that kind of culinary, that ability to feed yourself and the knowledge of what that vegetable or fruit holds in order to grow. And I think that's a really important thing. I mean, it's not just happening in Gaza. The weaponization of food is happening all over the world in many different places. We often think of the withholding of food, starvation, as the kind of the most significant way that food is weaponized. But what really surprised me writing this book was the extent to which the powerful will really study their enemy's food culture in a way to undermine it and destroy it as a way to destroy their enemy. And one of the things that really struck me is how the Chinese government is not withholding food from Uyghurs in Western China, but forcing them to eat an entirely new cuisine. They're forcing them to eat more food like the majority Han culture as a way to undermine, to de-Uyghur Uyghurs themselves. They're taking Uyghur children away from their homes and putting them in boarding schools, forcing them to speak another language, forcing them to eat other foods. I mean, this maybe sound very familiar to Australians. It's very familiar to what the United States did to indigenous communities, same
indeed,
as Canada.
Indeed, the parallels
indeed.
Are strong.
And so what the Chinese are doing in Western China and Tibet is a modern analog to what the country just mentioned did to their indigenous populations.
It's a recognition of the importance and the strength of food culture as part of the culture of a people.
It is. It's really powerful. It's really powerful. And, you know, and to me, we talk about women and girls in the human rights world, about women and girls being disproportionately impacted by war. And the subtext is that because they're vulnerable, because they're weak, and weaker than other parts of society. And yes, to an extent, that is absolutely true. But I also think it's because they are incredibly powerful. They hold so much of our cultural memory. They build so much of our societies that if you undermine that really integral layer to our society, to their societies, you can almost destroy a people. And so that's why, again, protecting women and girls is so important.
The Chinese, the Chinese are also keeping a very close eye on the baking of bread. What is that about?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It's fascinating. Uyghur bread, naan to Uyghurs is almost life itself, culturally. And the Chinese Communist Party has been arresting bread makers on the street. And let me just kind of back up for a second and kind of explain what... Yeah. You know, Uyghur bakers are to a Uyghur community. It's not just the food itself. It's where the bakers are a place, the bakeries are a place where Uyghurs go on a daily basis to get their bread. But it's also where they meet their neighbors. They exchange gossip. They figure out what's going on. You know, and the bakers themselves are part of this process, so they kind of know what's up, what's going on in the communities. They are kind of a source of knowledge. And so the Chinese Communist government, or the Chinese Communist Party in one way, is going after Uyghur bakers because of their central node in kind of Uyghur cultural life. But also, they are applying a very traditional indigenous trade, which is independent of kind of Communist Party ideology. It's symbols that Uyghurs are different, and they don't like that. And so by going after this fundamental element of Uyghur cuisine and culture and society, they are ripping apart Uyghur society. And yeah, the bakers are just an incredibly profound, important part of Uyghur society, and I can't understate that.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Michael Shaikh about his book, The Last Sweet Bite. Michael, there's also, I was fascinated by this in the book, there is also the role that food distribution plays in holding societies together.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when we think about cuisine, we tend to think about the food itself and the recipes. But as you mentioned at the outset, there are specific ways of organizing a meal, specific ways of eating a meal and distributing meals and food. And particularly, I think, you know, where I talk about this most in the book is with the Rohingya in the camps. The Rohingya, and there's one dish in particular called guruguso. It is a beautiful beef curry. It's really fiery and has a huge amount of depth to it. And it's one of the most luscious curries, best recipes I've ever had in a long time. And it's really central to the Rohingya culture. And beef in particular, it really represents, you know, it's taken from cattle that have grazed Rohingya lands for centuries, and it's a really kind of central thing to them. But during the during religious holidays, during Eid, the more well-off will make guruguso and distribute this across the community to the homeless, to the less well-off, to those in need, the sick. And it's a way of taking care of their community. It's a way of emphasizing leadership roles in the community and responsibility, not just leadership, but responsibility of the elders and the leaders to their community. And in the Rohingya camps in Bangladesh, the Rohingya are forced to live on UN handouts. They can't work in the camps, so they can't earn extra money. They can't earn any money to buy their own food. And so they're forced to rely on food that doesn't really reflect the food from their homeland. And so it's very hard to make guruguso because they can't buy the beef necessary to make it. And when they can buy it, it's often low quality and it doesn't necessarily taste like home. And I think that's one thing we can underestimate, the power of taste in this. And then secondly, the Rohingya have these not only work restrictions, they have like restrictions on freedom on their movement inside the camp. So you can't have elders and leaders move freely to distribute the cuisine or distribute the guruguso, I mean, that central element of their cuisine. So it's leading to this kind of, not only has a genocide just been this juggernaut that has started to really unravel society, but these restrictions inside the refugee camps are doing profound damage as well by not being able to distribute the food. The social structures, the leadership structures are falling down, and that void is being filled by human traffickers and armed gangs. And so it's just creating this kind of cascading destruction. And, you know, that dish guruguso is central to keeping them whole.
You also write in the book about dishes that become symbols of resistance. And in particular, I mean, there are many peoples that you write about in the book. But one of the most moving parts of your book is about the Tamils.
Mm. Yeah. You know, just the mere act of surviving is a bit of a, you know, a middle finger to the people trying to erase you. And by cooking your own food and keeping your culture alive, that's like a double middle finger. I don't want to use the...
You've made your point.
Okay. But so it is, it's a real form of resistance by just being able to cook your own food in times of crisis. And the Tamil community in particular in Sri Lanka has faced nearly a generation of war. And that has forced a lot of Tamils into the diaspora as refugees and places in Europe and Australia and Canada where they're big communities. And often food, cooking their own food has been a form, not only a form of preserving a culture, preserving a food culture and keeping it alive outside of Sri Lanka, but it also has been a form of resistance to the violence. That mere act of keeping it alive, the mere act of cooking it in order to be able to take it home. And this is not just indicative to the Elam Tamils, but also to the Rohingya, also to the Uyghurs. You know, when many of my Uyghur friends, particularly in the Virginia area, when they started getting word about the internment camp system, they really turned to their own food as a form of solace and trying to learn their own recipes in which they really weren't cooking very much. They were eating more Western American food, but it forced them to reconnect with their culture. And in those moments, it not just became a form of solace, but a form of resistance. And you see this quite a bit across the world, that food as resistance.
But what can an agency do, like the United Nations or UNESCO, what can they do to protect a culture that is on the one hand so vulnerable, but on the other hand is so deeply, deeply part of people's culture? What's needed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I've been told by people at UNESCO that we protect food, intangible cultural heritage. There are these treaties that protect and celebrate at-threat food cultures. But they don't really do anything in times of war. I am not, my argument here is not about protecting food cultures in peacetime. It is about specifically when violence breaks out. We need to pay better attention to when refugees cross an international border, because when they do, they are disassociated, they're disconnected from their land, they're disconnected from their food sources, they're going into a new culture. And by understanding they're not eating their own food, having more culturally relevant food being distributed to them by, say, the World Food Program, they're doing a better job, but not as good as they should. But recognizing, just paying attention, really, that this is happening, and food culture, by keeping a food culture intact, you can keep a people intact. I mean, Jose Andres, the world-renowned Spanish chef, Spanish-American chef, is doing a lot of this through World Central Kitchen. He's kind of a role model for, I think, how big UN agencies should be paying attention. But really, there is, when you look at the laws and policies around protecting culture in war, there is nothing that prescribes attention and protection to food culture in war. Not peacetime, but wartime. And that's really, really important to a lot of people, because you need to be able to see your own, if you see your own food, it kind of reaffirms your identity and it can keep your community whole, like the Goroguso. By having that food distributed across the camps, even in very tense times, it can keep a Rohingya community intact in some measure. So I think it's really important just to recognize it. And it's not an expensive thing to do.
And you decided to include in the book recipes.
Yes.
Yes. At what point in this process did you decide that, apart from an eloquent argument about the preservation of culture, you would tell us how to cook it?
Well, it wasn't me that had to tell you how to cook it. It was the people who gave me the recipes that, you know, many of those recipes were given to me as gifts to take out of conflict zones so they would survive. And also with the express intention that they be given to other people so they could cook, so that knowledge could spread. But also as a way for those recipes, as a way to teach others and expose others to another culture. And to show, you know, for example, that we talked about Sri Lanka, that Elam Tamil crab curry is such a wonderful dish. And for many people, it nearly disappeared. Many families. And by having that recipe that a woman named Rajiva, who gave it to me in that book, is an expression of her family and her culture. And it's a way for her to have others know about her and her people. Almost every recipe in that book was given to me with that purpose, for people to cook it, for people to understand, for people to fall in love with that food.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
I've been talking to Michael Shake, whose book, The Last Sweet Bite, is available in Australian bookshops. Michael is out in Australia next week, and we will put on our website details of his programs around the place. He's going to be in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, etc., etc., etc. This is Late Night Live.